Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. Throughout January 2022, a potpourri of delicious guests are taking a jaunty stroll through Peter Jackson's Get Back, day by day, every day, on the day. In this episode, it's a welcome return to writer, broadcaster and host of the excellent Haunted Generation radio show, Bob Fisher. Hello.
Hello, Chris. How are you?
I'm fine. How was Get Back for you?
That's not an easy question to answer, is it?
No.
In words of one syllable. I thought it was extraordinary. I think, like lots of people, I found it like incredibly illuminating, and it shattered a lot of illusions that we'd had about those sessions. Because I think we spoke the last time about the way the Beatles story has almost become folklore. And it's like, it's almost like an oral tradition that gets passed down from generation to generation. And the folklore that we'd been told about the Get Back sessions, you know, not least by some of the Beatles themselves, was that they were extraordinarily fractious and everybody was in a foul mood and tempers were flaring. And it's just not like that at all. I mean, they all appear to be having rather a jolly time and they're all doing their best to do a great thing, to make a great album, to put on a great performance. I didn't detect any great fractiousness between any members of the Beatles in the whole thing. And I think the other thing about it is that, again, despite so much having been written about those sessions and said about those sessions, it's the first time that I've had a real idea of the chronology of it. So to see it, and I thought it was a work of genius the way that Peter Jackson did it, to see it unfold day by day, to see them arriving for work and knocking off at the end of the day and everything that happened in between just gives an absolute, like a whole new perspective to it. And it's fascinating to see. I want documentaries about everything to be 8 hours long and day by day. I want to see an eight-hour documentary about the making of Mouldy Old Dough by Lieutenant Pigeon, please. That's Peter Jackson's next project. Yeah. So, yeah, no, terrific. And I tell you what, the rooftop concert made me unexpectedly emotional. I welled up during the rooftop concert because the buggers, having spent 3 weeks basically looking like they weren't going to pull it off, they suddenly march casually up onto the rooftop of 3 Savile Row. And they do. And they play the best versions of those songs that they've played since the whole session started. I've got a feeling in particular. It's spine tingling. So that's beautiful to see. And George nails the little descending guitar bit, doesn't he, on the rooftop. It's the first time we've seen him do it on the rooftop. He finally gets it right. So when the pressure is on, they do it. But it's the reactions of the people in the street below that's just glorious. And again, oh, yeah. We've got this folk memory of, you know, people came out and complained and fusty old businessmen. And obviously some did. But the general reaction in the street is just overwhelmingly, oh, wow, this is great. The Beatles should do it every lunchtime. Even from the old codgers that they interview that you would think would be like, no, this is a disgrace. And they say, oh, no, it's great, Governor. I'd let my daughter marry a Beatle. There's a lot of that around, and it's heartwarming. It's beautiful. Sorry, this isn't the day that you asked me about at all, is it? I told you I'd go on a bit.
Okay, so let's go in. So it's day 18. It's Monday, the 27th of January, 1969. The first thing we see are some old rock and roll songs. Shake, Rattle and Roll, Kansas City.
Do you know what? This is reassuring in a way, because I've been in bands over the years, and I am in a band now. Hello to the fellow members of Old Muggins. And what bands do, more than anything else, is piss about, quite frankly. If you get a bunch of musicians together in a room, they will waste time. They will arse around, and they will attempt to play songs they've never played before for no other reason than it's something to do. So it's really reassuring to see the Beatles doing exactly that at a period when, like, they are under pressure. Because I think, like, the extraordinary thing about the whole Get Back sessions is they arrive with 3 weeks to write an album from scratch, record an album from scratch, put on their first live performance for 3 years, playing the songs that they haven't written yet. And they're still, with like a fortnight to go, they're still saying, oh, should we do something on an oil rig? how have you not planned this a bit further in advance? So it's amazing to see. Like, with days to go before their first public appearance for 3 years, they're still messing about, just jamming on songs that they quite clearly played in Hamburg. So we've got Shake, Rattle and Roll is in there, isn't it? Kansas City, they have a crack at as well. A song called Miss Anne.
It's a segue with Lordy Miss Claudie, isn't it?
Yeah, Little Richard song. So that's really interesting to hear. I love the little bit during those performances as well. It's during the playback, I think. Because the impression I get over and over again from watching the four Beatles together is that it's the dynamic of like almost of the school playground, and you can fully imagine them. You can still see them as teenagers.
Yeah.
And there's just a bit where, I think it's during the playback of Miss Anne, actually, where Lennon has pulled his T-shirt down over his knees and he's bouncing along.
Yeah.
Like he's doing a terrible Toulouse-Lautrec impersonation. Yeah. You know, a thing where people take their shoes off and put them on their knees. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it looks like they're really short. He's done that with his T-shirt. And I used to get told off for doing that at school. I used to do that all the time.
Stretch your jumper, yeah.
Yes. Stand up, Fisher, and walk properly, or you'll do yourself a mischief. So that was really nice to see. And the other thing that I loved, Paul McCartney during that playback is miming playing an upright bass. And he's quite clearly, he's doing air Bill Black.
Yes.
He's pretending that he's Elvis's bassist, Bill Black. Quite obviously, yeah. He's twirling around an air bass. Doesn't Paul McCartney now actually own Bill Black's double bass?
He does, yeah. We can hear it on McCartney 3, actually. So he's still using it.
Does he play it on there? Right, amazing. Yeah. I remember seeing a documentary years ago where he kind of casually pointed it out. So there's Bill Black's bass over there. That's the one he plays on the Sun Sessions.
Yeah.
So there's a nice bit of prescience there as well. Wasn't it great as well? The jiving. Lennon and McCartney, again, like we're told, they were fractious, they were barely speaking. It's clearly bollocks. They are thick as thieves during the Get Back sessions. And that little moment where they start jiving, and it's proper rock and roll jiving in the control room, is just glorious. And I tell you what, they're not half bad either, are they?
That's right. Yeah, I thought that. Yeah.
They're decent little movers, the pair of them.
Yeah. It's just so good to see them all so happy. They've been through a lot, and the sessions are clearly, they're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel at this point.
I think so.
John's talking about, there's a brief mention where he says he hadn't had any sleep. I was just so high. He's quite happy, quite openly. Oh, okay.
But it's not like he was out. He wasn't high because he was like out at some rock and roll party or anything, was he? He was watching the telly. It was basically the John Lennon equivalent of Netflix and chill. But I don't know what he was watching. Well, there is a bit in a previous episode where they talk about having watched Out of the Unknown, isn't there?
Yeah.
And then there's one, I think Lennon in one episode says, did anybody watch Hancock last night?
Yes.
Which I thought was great. So he's quite, yeah. I mean, we know that, I mean, you know, it's a delicate subject to broach, but I think we know that Lennon was a heroin user during this point in his life. Just the prospect of him, like, taking heroin and then sitting in front of Hancock's half hour on BBC One is like an extraordinary collision of cultural...
Yeah.
And societal effects. It's a strange thing to contemplate.
It's hard to imagine Sid James on Skag. I don't know, that must be so surreal.
Can we get that trending, do you think, when this goes out? Hashtag Sid James on Skag. Somebody will do that for us, won't they?
Thanks, folks. So yeah, George has had a busy weekend as well. He's brought in a new song, which is described as a happy and a rocker. And he mentions...
Yes!
You know, He only finished it because he's still following John's advice from years earlier. As soon as you start a song, finish it.
Yes. Which John Lennon says that he never actually follows himself, doesn't he? So I can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
He's written Old Brown Shoe, which appears to have kept him up all night and means he didn't have any breakfast either.
No.
Which is, and you know, it was really interesting looking at the way the Beatles not only compose their own songs, but take on advice from basically anybody else that's in the studio, not just the other Beatles. Because I think in like previous days, Mal Evans has chipped in suggestions for songs. And with Old Brown Shoe, have I got this right? That wonderful kind of discordant bit in Old Brown Shoe, where there's as people will gather, I'm not an expert on musical notation here, but there's like a wonky note in Old Brown Shoe, as there is in a few of George's songs, because I Want to Tell You has got one as well. It's the same kind of thing. That appears to be suggested by Billy Preston.
I don't know if it is. I think he's written that, and he's asking Billy what the name of the chord is. What would you call it?
Oh, is he? Right, okay.
I love the thought that Billy did do that, though. But there's so many, like you said, there's so many of them in George, like discordant, diminished chords, and that sort of thing. It's got to be George. But I love that. I don't really play piano, but what is that chord called?
Well, that's the great thing about it, I think, is because he says that, doesn't he? He says it's great that I don't play the piano because he doesn't know what he's doing, and that almost makes for better songwriting. And I've got a long-standing theory of mine. Is that every band needs at least one willful non-musician in their lineup, or at least a musician that's willing to step outside their comfort zone, because that's where ideas come from. Yeah. And accidents often make for the best music, and moments where you don't know what you're doing and it surprises you as a songwriter. And I tend to think, like, bands that are filled with very proficient musicians playing the instruments that they are proficient on can actually be pretty dull. Mm. You know, there's no surprises in there. They know exactly what they're doing. Whereas I think if you have a willful, absolutely in some cases, a non-musician in a band. And I'm thinking of people like, you know, Brian Eno in early Roxy Music, I think would probably admit he wasn't any kind of keyboard player. You know, he pushed a button on a synth and made funny noises, but oh god, the ideas that he brought. You know, you can't imagine those early Roxy Music albums without Brian Eno's contribution. He's barely a musician at all. I think you always need somebody like that in a band. You need somebody to mess it up, somebody to say, well, you know what, they're not going to say, oh, that chord needs to be an E sus 9 with a descending whatever. I say, I have no idea what I'm talking about. What you need is somebody to go, it should be going duh, 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 instead of duh, 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 duh. Yeah. I once saw a great interview with Phil Oakey from the Human League, where he said, who's the Human League's producer, Martin Rushent? And I'm sure Phil Oakey was once asked, like, what did Martin Rushent bring to the Human League recordings? And he said, oh, we had a song that went da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And Martin Rushent said you should put da-da on the end of it. So it goes da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yes.
That's the kind of musical contribution I could go with.
Yeah.
I think to the Beatles' credit, there's often a lot of that about the Beatles' own experimentation. Because who's that? The musicologist that said, oh, you know, the Beatles end their songs with an aeolian cadence. Mm. And John Lennon said, I thought that was some sort of exotic bird.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, the Beatles did this stuff, but they had no idea that they were doing it. Mm. I think was Lennon once surprised at how many different time signature changes there were in Good Morning, Good Morning. Because it just had never occurred to him that he was doing time signature changes. He just wrote what came natural to him. And I think that's brilliant. I think that's how you should write.
Absolutely, yeah. Well,
there are no rules.
Exactly. Well, as will now be proved. Because when he's playing it, Paul is behind him and he's really encouraging. You think how he was during Twickenham. I think he's taken on board some of the comments.
Yes.
Be a bit more encouraging. And he really is. And then he gets on drums. And then you get Billy Preston on bass when Ringo goes on drums and Paul on lead. But Billy's playing bass.
Yeah, he plays guitar a couple of times as well, doesn't he, I think, Billy Preston? Yeah. It's really interesting to see how they swap over a lot. And again, I think it makes for great results because there's a great bit. It's definitely in this particular day where George Martin says, you know, he puts it very euphemistically, but he says, I wonder if it's an idea to turn your bass down a little bit, John. Yeah. He said, yeah, all right. Yeah. No need to rub it in. He's not the greatest bassist in the world. But I think despite what has been written about Lennon's bass playing on those sessions over the years, I don't think it's anywhere near as bad as people have made out. I know Ian MacDonald in Revolution in the Head basically described Lennon's bass playing on The Long and Winding Road as an act of sabotage. If not intentional through the actual playing, but leaving it on the finished take was an act of sabotage. And I'm not so sure about that when I hear it with the benefit of hindsight. I've heard far worse musical aberrations on finished products than John Lennon's bass playing on that. I like the looseness of it all and the fact they were willing to swap instruments and have a crack. That's what I like about the Beatles.
Yeah. I always get the feeling with John when he's playing bass, it's beneath him. I don't know. It's sort of, because invariably it'll be, if we need a, you know, they're swapping instruments, it'll be George. George is like the Kevin Harrington of the band. George, come play bass. And I don't know.
I dare say it's not his favourite thing to do. But again, what comes over is that none of them were precious about it. And despite, again, that folklore of it being fractious and uncooperative, all they're doing, all of them, is doing their best in a really professional way to make the sessions work and to make the songs work. And if the best way to do it is to put John Lennon on bass, you know, he doesn't complain about it. He just does it. Yeah. He does his best.
Yeah.
Well, I'm always slightly baffled as to why he played the bass. Why did Paul McCartney play the piano and put John Lennon on the bass when, quite frankly, you've got Billy Preston, who's an extraordinary keyboard player, and Paul McCartney, who's an extraordinary bass player. Why didn't they just play? Having just said, you know, it's often exciting when musicians don't play the instruments they're proficient on. I'm not questioning why they didn't. I'm full of contradictions, aren't I? But it might have made more sense in that particular case.
Yeah. We had a conversation before, actually, as to why John plays the guitar solo on Get Back. And when you see the footage, I think it's little more than he was the last to arrive. So they were playing it. And George was kind of doing the rhythm because there was no one else there. Yeah. John Lollop's in whatever time. And he's got nothing to do, so he starts fiddling. It might be something as simple as that throughout this.
But does a great job on it, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Again, I think Lennon is... Like sort of folklore says that Lennon wasn't the greatest guitarist, and he was certainly reticent about his own guitar playing, because I've seen interviews with him from the 70s where I think it's the Dick Cavett shows that he does the 1970s, where he's asked, you know, I think they'd asked him to do a live performance in the studio, some sort of acoustic thing, and he basically says, I'm not a good enough musician to do that. So right, I think Lennon was kind of reticent about his own musical abilities. But when you see him playing, you know, lead guitar on things like Get Back, it's cracking.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody else could have, but I don't think George would have done it as well.
Yeah.
The little fills and the little solos that he does on Get Back are just glorious, I think.
They really are. So then they're doing Let It Be, and there's some problems with the PA, because they complain at the drums, you know, going through the PA. And it's basically there's microphones everywhere. But they go through a quick take of it, and Billy plays just the most exquisite keyboard section. It's beautiful. And Paul's sort of saying, they always do that generic northern voice, you know, Billy coming from north. North of England. It doesn't come easy, all this soul.
All this soul stuff. Don't come easy. No, it's beautiful, isn't it? There's a phrase that George Martin uses during that section as well that brought a little rosy glow to my heart, which is howl round.
Yeah.
Which is, I'm coming from a background as a Doctor Who fan and a fan of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, howl round is a word that I know well, which is basically when you get feedback because all the microphones are open, all the amps are open, and they all pick up each other and you get feedback. But, you know, that can be used to exciting effect on recordings. So to hear George Martin saying that, I thought was was great. That it made my eyes light up, that. They're quite self-critical during that performance as well, aren't they? Because McCartney himself says, it's a bit ploddy, isn't it? So again, it's sort of interesting they're not precious about their own material at all. Is that the take as well? It might be that one. Who keeps calling them Honey Bunch all the time? Is it Glyn Johns? You never actually see him do it. It's a disembodied voice.
Mm. It's either him or George. I think it's him.
It cannot possibly be George Martin. No. There is nothing in my psyche, nothing in my 49 years upon this planet that would lead me to believe that George Martin would call anybody Honey Bunch.
It's got to be Glyn.
Even Mrs. Martin, Lady Martin, surely never got called Honey Bunch.
It is Glyn, because by now Glyn's Phyllis, isn't he? Glynis. So it might be a little in-joke between them.
Well, I was a little disappointed that you actually gave me a day to talk about when Glyn Johns is actually quite soberly dressed.
Well, yeah.
he could just about pass for a regular guy in the street in 1969 on day 18, which is a little bit disappointing because, quite frankly, for most of the time, he's dressed. I mean, I actually made a list of Glyn Johns's like various outfits during the Get Back session. Well, there's the Mod Womble, which is
I call that his Bungle from Rainbow outfit.
It's amazing. Like the Abominable Snowman.
Mod Womble.
I don't know if anybody has seen the film Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, the Russ Meyer film.
Yeah.
And there's a record producer character in that called Z-Man, who is a dead ringer for Glyn Johns in his Mod Womble phase. I'd be amazed. Apparently Z-Man is sort of based on Phil Spector, but I'd be amazed if nobody had seen Glyn Johns's clobber when they were thinking about Z-Man's get-up. So there's the Mod Womble. There's one where he appears to be dressed as a member of Shawaddy Waddy.
Yes.
But he's got the full kind of, like a blue drape jacket on. There's one where, fantastically, my friend Kevin Davis, who worked on the TV series Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy in the early 1980s, Kevin has identified that Glyn Johns is wearing the exact same blazer that David Dixon is wearing in his role as Ford Prefect.
No way! Really?
And Kevin pointed out that the BBC got Ford Prefect's blazer. This is kind of 10 years later, but they got it from the trendy London clobber shop Lord John. Which, like, and if anybody was going to shop at Lord John, it would surely be Glyn Johns.
Wow, that's amazing.
It is. It's the same blazer. And there's a day when he looks, Glyn Johns looks for all the world like, I guess it's not especially politically correct these days, but do you remember Dick Emery's character who said, "Hello, honky tonks"?
Oh, yes. Yes.
There's one where Glyn Johns is a dead ringer for him.
Yeah.
Well, you bear in mind, this wasn't a bloke. Like, he wasn't going to a party or anything.
No.
He was just going to work in a recording studio for the day. Well, you're imagining getting up on a morning. Oh, what should I put on today? Yeah. I think today is my Mod Womble day. I would have looked like, because, you know, if I went out, like, dressed like that in the middle of January in central London, quite frankly, within 5 minutes, I would look like Pigpen from Charlie Brown. Yeah. I'm a bloke who can't wear a pair of white jeans. within seconds of them leaving the house, they're dark grey.
Yeah. But, Glyn, he's amazing. John is asking the sound engineer, Dave Harris. He actually says, get a mic for Billy, too. So he's keen to get Billy on vocals. And then they do the Long and Winding Road. And as you say, yeah, Paul's saying it's plodding a bit and there's nobody really giving him any help with it. And I don't know if it's the editing, but John looks really peed off. I don't know if it's been edited in from a different moment.
I must admit, I'd never noticed any parts where Lennon looked particularly cheesed off.
So he's just sort of staring.
I'd tip my hat if you've spotted that. I guess it comes to us all. It's easy to read stuff into these things, isn't it? Like, is Lennon bubbling over with fury at the indignity of playing in this song, or is he just having a moment where he thought, I wonder what we should have for tea tonight? Should we have fish cakes? Which, you know, these moments come to us all.
Paul just says, oh, I give up. But George says, oh, that's nice, though. And again, they're moaning at George about the PA, but George is... He's basically saying, and he's so calm. He's saying, there's so many mics around here that sounds good. For example, why don't you just open the piano lid for a start? They hadn't even considered. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think, again, all bands have faced these problems.
Yeah.
where you sit looking at each other saying, doesn't sound like it should sound like, what can we do here? And you start messing about with microphones. It is entirely reassuring to see that the biggest band in the world had these troubles as well. Isn't there a point during that section as well where Yoko's divorce comes through? That kind of distracts them a little bit.
That I find this really interesting because this is on Anthology 3 when they're doing Oh Darling.
And yeah.
Halfway through the song, because on audio, you just hear, you know, they slow down the song and John announces, you know, Yoko's divorce has gone through. And now we actually get to see their reactions because you can't hear anything.
Yeah.
And there's definitely some editing here because it pans to George and he's smiling really happily. But then when it cuts back to John, you see he's actually tuning up his guitar. So he's not really listening. But the big reaction is with Paul, who does like a little Richard, woo!
Yes.
And when they carry on the song, it's just fascinating because John and Paul just look at each other all the time after that, after they're singing. Believe me, it's very, very, very strange, very moving.
Lennon drops it into the lyric, doesn't he? He does a kind of, they told the lawyer it's okay.
Yeah.
I love these little micro moments of history that have now been, well, they'd always been captured, but now we've got them, now we've seen them. Again, it's that thing about folklore. You know, we knew that Yoko's divorce came through during the sessions, but to actually see the moment when somebody comes in, you know, when Lennon troops in and says, "I've just got it, it's here." It's incredible. It's very touching to have these private moments completely immortalised.
Because when he's singing, "I'm free," he changes the lyrics. Yes. As you say. He's all smiles, but he's singing that to Paul, not to Yoko, which I find insightful. Is he saying, I'm free from the band, or am I?
Nah, I'm not sure. I think I don't know if that's reading too much into
Probably.
It again. Like, people
do,
just
Bob.
Piss about, don't they? People. I think throwaway comments, you could, with the benefit of hindsight, you can say, yes, he meant that. Well, in actual fact, it was just something that he said off the cuff and on the day. And it, you know, at the time, nobody thought a single thing about it. The relationship between Lennon and McCartney is always a fascinating one. But again, what I found reassuring about these sessions is that it's just so ordinary. You know, they're not gods going up against each other, titans battling each other for control of the Beatles. It's something that Lennon was always really keen to stress, like especially in his interviews after the Beatles had broken up, where his entire shtick was basically, I'm just a guy, you know, when we were just a band, we were a very big rock and roll band, but that's all we were.
Yeah.
And I think that really comes over. And for me, That's so touching. They're not gods. They're not superhumans. They are just guys. And Get Back really humanizes them. And it's moments like that that really brings it home.
Absolutely, yeah. Next we've got Don't Let Me Down. This is another lovely little moment because they've both written down different lyrics. And they think that it's, and if somebody ever really loved me like she does... Hang on, that's wrong.
Yeah.
That's definitely not how it went. And we see John actually change the lyrics. Wow.
Yeah, totally.
He's writing the song.
Yeah, and we see a lot of that, don't we? There's that incredible moment where McCartney starts playing Get Back and it's just one, it's a chord on his bass.
Yeah.
And you see it evolve from there. There's the moment where George brings in something. And something in the way she moves attracts me like a pomegranate, I think, is his original line for it. So you see all these little moments. I'm delighted that I think these films in particular have provided like a rehabilitation for Don't Let Me Down, which I think, and I've always thought, is one of the great lost Beatles moments. And I think it, you know, that theory of... like parallel universes where, you know, the turn left, turn right theory. If you turned left at that moment at the junction, your life would have gone in a completely different direction, but you didn't, you turned right. But somewhere there's a parallel universe where you did turn left and there's an alternative you in a different dimension that did all those things. Now, for me, Don't Let Me Down, and particularly the performances in Get Back, is a kind of turn left moment for the Beatles, because I think... they didn't realise it at the time, but Don't Let Me Down is their new direction. And Don't Let Me Down could and should have been a new lease of life for the Beatles, because it's a song, I don't think it sounds particularly like anything else that they recorded. It's loose. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit stoned. It's kind of cool and it's laid back and it's kind of sexy. You know, nobody ever done me like she done me. Ooh, she done me. You know, there's nothing really like that in any other Beatles songs. Just the whole ambience of it is completely different. It's very of the late 60s. You know, it's kind of... It's almost got the feel of that sort of, you know, West Coast, like American stoned rock of the late 60s. You can imagine, you know, when the Grateful Dead went back to their roots and did all sort of country rock stuff. There's sort of elements of that in there. But I think they were tantalizingly close to having like a whole new incarnation of the Beatles at this point. And what they should have done, says a bloke sitting in a room 10 miles from Middlesbrough by himself, giving advice to the greatest rock and roll band of all time. What they should have done was abandoned the kind of the no overdubs. We're going to make a pure album that's live in the studio. Which was a ridiculous edict and utterly pointless. Nobody cared either way, whether they're overdubs or not. And great as the rooftop gig is, and it is a wonderful spine-tingling moment, there was no need for them to do it. They didn't need to be putting pressure on themselves to build up to this live performance. But I think what they had was a band that had grown up, a band that had grown up and was willing to relax and to make cool and mature, in inverted commas, music, because they were all pushing 30 and they'd become cool and mature themselves. And they also had Billy Preston, which they'd never had before. And Billy Preston adds so much to the Beatles at that stage. And I think that what they should have done at that point was say, right, forget all of the other stuff, forget the live performance, forget the no overdubs things. We are going to make an album with this band traditionally in this studio. Doesn't have to be live. We can drop in if we like, we can do overdubs if we like, but this band in this room is brilliant. It's working. The new songs sound fantastic. Scrap everything. Let's have another... I know Ringo had to go off and make the Magic Christian, but, you know, let's reconvene, or at some point we'll have another 3 months in this studio with this setup. It's a lovely place to work. Everybody's getting on. You would have had the Get Back album that we should have had in 1969. And I think that was a brilliant new direction for them. And much as I love Abbey Road, Abbey Road is an extraordinary album in so many ways, but it doesn't have that feel. They still could have done Abbey Road. They still could have gone back with George Martin into their traditional studio setup and done Abbey Road at some point. But I think the feel they have in the Savile Row studio with that band, that setup, is just utterly unique in the Beatles' history. And it's such a shame that they didn't follow it and we didn't get more of it. But Don't Let Me Down is that feel encapsulated for me. It's perfect.
Lovely.
Sorry, I go on a bit, don't I?
No, I'm just trying to think of how I can smoothly segue these few bullet points I've made after all that. Okay. So I'm not even going to bother. So, his bullet points: Ringo's spotty red shirt, George's boots, and the absolute state of the studio. Any thoughts?
Nothing wrong with Ringo's spotty red shirt. Oh, don't they take the piss out of Ringo in one episode for wearing a shirt that he bought in 1967? They are. You're still wearing that old shirt. It's a blimey. I've got shirts that I bought in 1997. I'm still wearing.
But I do want to touch on George's boots in this.
George's boots are incredible. Talking of one again, boots. It's the Glyn Johns thing, isn't it? What you know, if anybody else, realistically, if I was getting up and all I was going to do that day was go like meet some mates in a completely private building and rehearse some songs. We're like, well, just chuck a T-shirt on and a pair of trainers. I'm away. It'll take me 2 minutes. George is wearing a vibrant purple shirt. He's wearing pink striped trousers and boots the likes of which I've never seen anywhere else. They're kind of, I describe, sort of flowery womble boots, aren't they?
How many wombles are there to die during this?
It's like a peeled banana at the top. Yeah. It's like the peel of a furry banana. It's absolutely extraordinary. I think my grandma used to have a sofa with that pattern on it in about 1973. Yeah, they're amazing. God, and at the point, like, everybody else is dressing down, like Lennon's. Because Lennon says in Twickenham, doesn't he, I've got my continuity clothes on. Because he's basically... I mean, again, this is potentially linked to his heroin habit at the time, but Lennon doesn't appear to change his clothes for the first week at all.
No.
He just that coat the same must gear reek. Every day. In an era before male grooming is what it is today.
Yeah.
And McCartney is just kind of, you know, McCartney's just sort of like shirts and waistcoats and stuff, isn't he? But he's not, you know, he's not dressed like he's like on the corner of Haight Ashbury with no. Georgies.
So at this point where the Beatles go to lunch, and there's a little moment where all the sound guys jump on their instruments.
Isn't that funny?
I think that's Alan Parsons on keyboards.
I think it is, yes, because he was tape operator at the time, wasn't he, Alan Parsons? Yeah. Is Chris Thomas in there as well somewhere? He's certainly around the studio on that day, isn't
he?
It's Chris
room,
Thomas
yeah.
who later went on to produce, he produced Nevermind the Bollocks and Different Class for Pulp, didn't he? He was a kind of Britpop producer of choice, Chris Thomas.
Back to the Egg by Wings, obviously.
And he did play piano on the White Album as well, Chris Thomas, I'm sure he did. I think he played on Long. Yes, he does play on Bungalow Bill, and I think he plays the harpsichord on Piggies.
Yes,
there you go. Yes. So Chris Thomas is certainly in there as well, but it is a brilliant moment. Again, I think it just shows the camaraderie in the studio. Everybody's, you know, these sessions that we were told were fractious. Everybody's just having a bit of a laugh, really, and getting on, and nobody minds. Apple seems like a really happy place to work, I think.
More of which later. So now we've got John Paul, Yoko and Michael Lindsay-Hogg, and they're with designer Gene Mann. Looking at some designs. Just so people know, it was Gene who took the photo of the Apple logo and also did the back sleeve of Sgt. Pepper. So he's got some
form. How did he do that? Right. I know that Gene was the guy who, it was his idea on Beatles album labels, that it's got the apple on one side. On side A, you get the full apple, and on side B, you've got like the sliced apple.
Yeah.
And that was Gene Marn's idea, apparently.
Good old Gene.
Can I drop in a couple of other little knick-knacks that I spotted from around that period?
Please.
Can I mention the mugs, coffee mugs that they're all drinking from, which I, quite frankly, want. Because, Chris, I have something of a fetish for vintage kitchenware. And those they're all drinking from, I assume, like somebody at Apple went out and bought a job lot of these mugs.
Yeah.
Probably from like what's the big posh shop on near Regent Street? I can't remember.
Harrods.
I don't remember Harrods. Chris, come on, give me some credit here.
Selfridges.
I can't remember.
Don't know.
No, I can't.
W. H. Smith is posh to me.
So it's not W. H. Smith. It's not Presto's. Somebody's been dispatched down there to get these mugs that have just got these beautiful horizontal brown stripes on, and I want them, quite frankly. There's a brilliant Twitter account and a fanzine called The Teatles, which is basically dedicated to the Beatles drinking tea, which there are endless photos of the Beatles drinking tea. So, and I believe that was the thing that the Teatles fanzine got really excited about, was those mugs. The other thing, I think that particular segment of this particular day is the first proper glimpse I've had of a Leslie cabinet, which I got quite excited about.
Yes, that gets wheeled in.
Which, for those unaware, the Leslie cabinet. Now, again, I'm not an expert here, but the Leslie cabinet is like you feed your guitar through it, and it revolves, and it makes that beautiful chiming guitar sound that it's absolutely all over Abbey Road. I think pretty much all of George's guitar on Abbey Road has been put through a Leslie cabinet. Now, in my head, a Leslie cabinet was like, you know, it wasn't that big. A Leslie cabinet would be the size of a box that you'd bring a little bit of shopping back from the supermarket. You know, when you get a delivery from Tesco, it's in a manageable box that can be handed over on your doorstep. Yeah. That's what I thought a Leslie cabinet would look like. But it's like a bloody wardrobe. It's absolutely enormous. If you stepped through the Leslie cabinet in Savile Row Studios, you'd come out in Narnia. You'd be pushing through Glyn Johns's womble coat.
Yeah.
And you'd suddenly find snow crunching underneath your feet.
Yeah. One thing I've noticed, Michael Lindsay-Hogg's role in the whole project, comparing his role at Twickenham to Savile Row.
Yeah.
He's a lot more subservient at Savile Row because he was very bolshy at the beginning. He's still putting in ideas. But before where he'd be really forceful, like it, where he was continually telling Ringo, we've got to go to Tripoli, we've got to go. Yes. I think he's learnt a lesson, because he's talking about hiring a helicopter to film some of the scenes on the rooftop.
Yes.
And the first thing, John, how much did it cost? It's between 1,000 and 1,200.
1,200 quid, isn't it? Yeah. It's a lot of money in 1969.
Yeah. And John said, well, but just book the helicopter and don't take any film. And Paul says, no, it's a no.
Yeah.
And then another one of those moments where you get, you actually hear something that you've heard forever, where John's singing the Sweet Loretta Fart, she thought she was a queen.
I always thought that was on the rooftop for some
reason.
I always thought he'd done that on the rooftop. But yeah, there's loads of little moments like that, aren't there? Where, because there's the bit where on the Let It Be album, it introduces Let It Be itself. It's like, we'd like to do Hark the Angels Come. And it's not, you know, when you see it in context, nothing to do with Let It Be, the song.
Yes.
He's just messing about in the studio. And Charles Hawtrey and the Deaf Aids, they're completely contextless. He's just essentially arsing about in the studio and putting on silly voices. But yeah, fascinating to see, like, where, you know, the moments when they actually came and where they appeared from. Yeah, Lindsay Hogg is a curious one, isn't there? There are moments in that first week at Twickenham where you think, God, why did they not tell him to do one? He's coming up with these ridiculous ideas that quite clearly none of them actually want to do.
Yeah.
Like you say, he's full on. But yeah, I think he calms down a little bit once they shift to Savile Row.
I think so. I think that's because now they're in their territory.
Totally, yes. Yeah, it's home turf, isn't it? Yeah, completely. So, I like the bit. I'm just rambling here, Chris. But there's again, typical band behaviour. There's a brilliant bit. I think it's just after the Sweet Loretta Fart, where McCartney kind of, like, in a very joking way, tells off John Lennon. And he says, hey, we're using valuable time up here, son. In that voice that he does quite a lot. Yeah. He's kind of like, he's sort of like factory floor foreman voice. Oi, all right, son.
Yeah, but they're doing it back, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah, they are. So he's clearly kind of aware that, you know, time is pressing and they've got to do a gig in 3 days. And you know, but then immediately after that, you're not quite sure if it's an edit, but then immediately after he said that and told Lennon off for wasting time, Paul just goes into like a really kind of jammed loose version of Take These Chains From My Heart. Well, who's wasting time here? Do another take of, you know, Long and Winding Road, because that's nowhere near finished. Get a shift on.
Yeah, because they're recording some of these as well. You know, they're recording these with a view to, right, this is what's going to be on the album.
And, no chance.
They say it's Glyn, but it sounds like George Martin to me, where it's saying, you do realise this tape is costing you 2 shillings a foot.
Yes! So George Harrison says, well, it's costing EMI 2 shillings a foot. Again, it's just like, it's what bands do. Bands will do anything but the task at hand. Anybody who's ever been in a band will be fully aware of the situation of, like, when you're trying to tune up, which is quite, you know, it's not a complex process, but it requires a little bit of concentration. So if one member of the band is trying to tune their guitar, like the other members of the band will be pissing about, making a racket behind you. Inevitably, it's the first law of being in a band, and they'll all be playing different things. They won't be doing anything.
No.
You'll have the bassist playing, you know, doong 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 on his bloody bass while you're trying to get your top E string right. So again, just reassuring to see all that happening with the Beatles. It's typical. It's displacement therapy, isn't it? It's distraction therapy. My friend Harry Pearson is an excellent writer, and he always says, like, basically, if you want to have the cleanest, tidiest house in your town, become a full-time professional writer, because quite frankly, you will do absolutely anything to avoid sitting down and actually writing the thing you're meant to be writing. You'll clean the windows, you'll hoover the stairs, you'll do anything. You'll put the fence back up, which I must do. And this is the Beatles equivalent of it. We've got 2-3 days before we need to do our first live performance in three years. But what the hell? Oh, there's time to do a jab of Take These Chains From My Heart.
Mm. they keep doing take after take of Get Back, and Glyn Johns is, what are you doing, effectively? You know, why are you keep doing this? But, because that one sounded okay, and they're convinced they could. And even George Martin jumps in. He says, look, I think you should do a different song, because if you keep doing this, you're going to go stale. Even Mal jumps in. He said, you can always go back to it.
Paul, I'm sick of hearing it.
Yeah. Paul says, do you want your head kicked in? And they do ignore everybody and do another take, which Glyn says is extremely good. And then Glyn's run out of tape, so he has to get another bit of tape in. And he's still not sure, so they do another take, and so it goes on. And George Martin suggests, well, you could always edit the good bits.
Yes!
But they're passionate, no.
Yeah, again, why? Because they, you know, had they announced particularly that they were going to make this completely grassroots album with no edits and no overdubs? And if they had, who cares? It didn't matter. The only people that were caring about doing a down the line, has to be live, has to be that take in that studio approach were the Beatles. I cannot for the life of me fathom why they were so attached to that idea. It didn't matter. You had the potential to make a brilliant 60s rock album with that band in that room. Do it. It doesn't matter if you've got to do an overdub or an edit. Just do it. It's fine.
Yeah. Because even George Martin takes the pee a bit, because he's saying, let's release it. Let's just do one take. He's, you know, saying that's their premise and that'll be it. And then we'll do it again. And then we'll do it again. Yeah. And then we'll do it again. I wonder if it's the Elvis comeback special, which would have been... I wonder if they had images of where he's sitting around, you know, with bands. I don't know.
Oh, do you know what? That had never occurred to me, because was that late 68 as well?
Yeah.
Wow. I wonder if they had thought that. Do you know what? That is a staggeringly good point, Mr. Shaw. And I think you might be spot on there. That they'd all seen that and thought, yeah, we need to do that. And that's why they're playing old rock and roll songs as well. I wonder. They needed to give... I was loving that in their that comeback special section that they give... There's a bit where Elvis... Again, it's like the Beatles swapping instruments. There's a bit where Elvis plays the lead guitar. And relegates Scotty Moore, who's one of the greatest lead guitarists of his generation, into playing, just like hammering out three chords on an acoustic guitar, while Elvis, bless him, has a go. He has a go at playing the lead guitar, doesn't he? And they give DJ Fontana, who's a brilliant drummer, they give him like a in my head, it's like a biscuit tin. It's like a packing case or a suitcase or something to hit.
Yeah. Just a thought, I don't know. But I think you're onto something.
I really do.
Yeah, so Get Back, they're sticking to their guns. And they said, right, we're going to do another take. And this is the one that appears on Let It Be. So they were right.
Yes, that's the actual take, isn't it? Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it does. Maybe it was worth the perseverance, because it does sound absolutely great.
Next we got I Got a Feeling. This is another one of those moments Paul's telling everybody, your instruments are all out of tune. And then Glyn announces that Paul's bass is out of tune.
And everybody goes, ah! Yeah. So again, we're back to being school kids, which is wonderful, because that's exactly what you would do.
Yeah. It's a great version, though. John's initial vocal on Everybody Had a Hard Year. His voice is a bit torn, but only for the first half. And the second half, it's really sweet. And you can see him, he messes up the lyrics, as always. Everybody had a hair down. And you can see him roll his eyes. Oh, blood.
John, you're in the studio. Write them down on a piece of paper in front of you.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Yeah, no, I've got a feeling it's one of my favourite Beatles songs of the period. And I think it's just a brilliant example, again, of, you know, having been told that Lennon and McCartney were working completely separately and didn't want to work on each other's songs at that point. Here they are bringing completely different things to the table and making a brilliant song out of their own very distinct personalities. You know, McCartney puts together a brilliant verse. You know, again, it's that glorious kind of, it's a loose late 60s rock sound that they didn't do that much. But McCartney puts together a brilliant verse that's just pure rock and roll passion. I got a feeling deep inside. And he really goes for it. The rooftop performance of that is extraordinary as well. But then only Lennon would sing Everybody Had a Wet Dream in the middle of that. And it works. And it works absolutely perfectly. You know, there aren't many mainstream songs about wet dreams, are there? Well, no. In fact, I can only think of two. One of which is that, and the other one is Max Romeo's "Wet Dream."
Yes, yeah.
Which is a bit of a reggae classic, which was banned by the BBC at the time of release, and Max Romeo protested and said it was a song about a leaky bedroom ceiling. So, I get absolute. Only Lennon would have stuck that in the middle of a Beatles song. And it was it not banned? Was that not banned by the BBC?
I don't know.
The BBC happy to broadcast the Wet Dream in I've Got a Feeling? Yeah. And maybe nobody at the BBC was aware of wet dreams in 1969. Well, maybe they hadn't been invented properly.
I also love the fact that that's the line that's being sung during the rooftop gig, and you've got that as Jason Hazy describes her, the indignant old woman. She, you know, I love the thought of her hearing that line.
It just doesn't make any sense.
I like the woman in that section as well. I can't think of it. Is she the same one that says it's woken her up?
Yes.
She's always having an afternoon nap. The older I get, the more I empathise with that. Yeah. I think I would, you know, much as I do like an afternoon nap, and I often drift off during the day these days, I think if the Beatles were playing on the roof opposite, I'd make an exception for them.
Well, that's it, Bob. But if we watch that in 30 years' time, are we all going to be supporting the old woman?
It's weird, isn't it? I would say as the main reaction from the people in the street is just is there's so much love for them. It's you know, from all generations, and you forget. I don't know. I think we've lost something, haven't we? It probably speaks volumes. I don't even know. Who would the biggest, like, 20-something band of the day be now? Who would they be? I don't know. I couldn't even tell you.
Well, there was an interesting thing David Hepworth did online on YouTube where he was saying about, you know, that the Beatles were, you know, they obviously get bigger as time goes on, but there aren't many bands now. You've got K-pop stuff, but it's mainly singers.
Yeah, that's true.
Or, you know, hitting the charts at least.
I see. There are thousands of bands out there, and I know lots of them and have worked with lots of them, but they're not having huge mainstream chart success in the main, I don't think. Yeah, I was just wondering if, like, a big artist of 2022 got up on a rooftop opposite me in the middle of the day, would I be really into it now?
Well,
at the age of nearly 50, maybe I wouldn't. Maybe I would be that old woman who's saying, "Can you turn it down a bit, please?" Because I've got two podcasts to be guests on this afternoon. You're making a bloody awful racket. It's playing havoc with my Audacity settings.
So we're in the control room. Glyn's there, George Martin's there, Chris Thomas is there. We've also got Apple press officer Sally Burgess, who's looking
Sally
very
Burgess, who looks cool. Dead ringer for Mia Farrow in Rosemary's Baby,
does,
I thought.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. Wearing her shades. And they're talking about Let It Be in Long Winding Road. Paul and Glyn are having a chat. And it's a strange dynamic because you've got George Martin sort of standing over. It's almost like he's, you know, just watching over, you know, to see how his protege is getting on.
Well, that kind of appears to be his role, doesn't it? George Martin is kind of, I think at this stage, he was ostensibly meant to be producing the album, but he's not. Glyn Johns is surely producing the album, really. Mm. It's him that's making the decisions and saying, that's a great take, that's not a great take, do that again. George Martin appears to be kind of, not relegated is the wrong word, but he's kind of an executive producer. If it was football, he'd be the director of football. He just kind of sticks his head around the door every now and again.
Yes.
And says, you might want to try that with a 3-5-2 for the next match.
But I don't know if it's, I'm sure it's subconscious because George is too much of a gentleman, but he kind of keeps reasserting his authority over Glyn in a way, because Glyn's really encouraging Paul to say, I think it's one of the songs where Paul's saying, oh, I'm not sure it's there yet. Glyn's words, I think it's very tasty, tray tasty.
Tray tasty. Yes.
Which I'm now going to use forever, that line.
That's very Austin Powers, isn't it? During that same conversation, like, have my ears deceived me here, Chris? Does Glyn Johns call one particularly legendary song, does he refer to it as the Long and Winding Scrotum?
Yeah. Bit harsh.
I mean, again, just Just as I'm no musical expert, I'm no medical expert, but I'd get that looked at if I were you, Glyn. But I don't know if anybody hears him. Nobody bats an eyelid, do they? But he does say it.
Yeah.
But George Martin's authority over Glyn, he's after his tray tasty line, George is saying, he's so good for your morale, this boy. Yes. And it's the word boy, really.
Yes.
You know.
How old was Glyn Johns at that point? Probably about 28. Yeah, totally. Yeah. No, it's a fascinating dynamic. I love, on the subject of which, there's a point during that where Ringo just gives Paul McCartney a lovely hug as well. And it's, apropos of nothing. It's not a particularly emotional moment. He's just sat next to him and he gives him a big hug. And I think that, they're so tactile all the way through. And again, I've seen interviews where McCartney has described kind of travelling to, in their earliest days, travelling to gigs in the freezing cold in the back of a van, and they'd lie on top of each other to keep warm. Mm-hmm. So, Lennon would lie on the floor of the van and McCartney would get on top of him, and then it would be somebody else's turn. George would lie on the floor of the van and Lennon would get on top of him just to keep warm in sub-zero temperatures, touring Scotland with Johnny Gentle, absolutely freezing. And when you see them in Let It Be, you think there is a band that are very, very tactile and very comfortable with each other physically. They do it a lot, don't they? They're often touching each other, Chris, and I think that's a lovely thing.
It really is.
Is Ringo pulling his grey hairs out as well?
Oh, I didn't see that.
Is he?
I didn't see just that. Cuts to,
I think that's what he's doing. It just cuts to, you don't actually see him do it, but he's been fiddling with his hair, and then it cuts to him, and he's got what looks like a long grey hair between his fingers.
Well, you think,
right, okay. Yeah. There's a man desperate to hold on to his youth, and we've all been there, Chris.
Absolutely. So, yeah, it's been, overall, it's been a really positive day. They've got some great songs out of it. And then it ends on just a slightly ominous, because they're saying, what time should we meet up tomorrow?
Yeah.
Paul announces, well, John's got something on at 1:30, and so have I. And Ringo says, well, what's going on? Paul says, I'm meeting a fella, and we all know who that is.
Enlighten me, Chris. Who was it?
Adam Klein.
It is Alan Klein. And Glyn Johns, he's kind of very subtly trying to warn them, I think.
Big time.
Oh, no, he's a bit weird. He's a bit strange.
Yeah.
We got some translation. Run for the fucking hills, lads. That's the translation, I think. No, because I wasn't sure if Paul was meeting, because it was Linda's dad that he wanted to take over as well, wasn't it? So I wasn't sure if Paul was maybe meeting him by himself. Yeah, that is the That is the great shadow on the horizon, isn't it, of the whole thing, is the kind of looming presence of Alan Klein. And it's so sad because, as I keep saying, I don't think there's any indication in the entirety of Get Back that they're at the end of the road. In fact, if anything, they look like a band that's loving being together and thriving on writing new songs, performing new songs, on playing together, which they clearly absolutely love doing. And in doing new stuff, in doing the rooftop gig, in being, they should have brought, I know they have a conversation about it and Paul decides it's maybe not a great idea because it's hard enough keeping four of them on the same page. But they should have brought Billy Preston in. I really think they should have brought him in as a full-time member and made an album with him, made a proper album with him, a proper studio album. I think they're on the verge of finding a form of the Beatles for the 1970s. And I think there was no reason why they couldn't have done that. But like you say, it's other stuff. It's non-musical stuff in the main. That's the shadow on the horizon. And it's really, those moments where Alan Klein is mentioned, really, they get at you. It's a little knife to the heart. Amidst all the positivity of the whole 8 hours, that is the chilling bit, isn't it? That's when you see Dracula. It's when you see Saruman in Lord of the Rings.
Really
not that
is.
I'm I think I am comparing Alan Klein to Saruman from Lord of the Rings, aren't I? I'll stick with it. Stick to your guns, Fisher.
He can't do you for slander. So, Bob, thank you so much. If you were Michael Lindsay Hogg, just imagine. Don't go too far.
Yes, I'm trying my best.
and we're approaching the end of Monday, the 27th of January, 1969, what would you be thinking about your projects?
I think I would be wondering whether I was going to get the conclusion to my film that I wanted. Because we're the 27th of January. The rooftop gig was meant to be on the 29th, but then got put back to the 30th. But they didn't. Did they know that at this stage? They didn't, did they, obviously? So as far as Michael Lindsay Hogg was concerned, there were 2 days left to the big live performance conclusion of his film. And the Beatles, for all their, you know, some of the stuff they're doing is brilliant and it sounds fantastic, they don't look particularly ready for a full public performance to me. I would not be thinking in 2 days' time, this band, the greatest band in the world, the biggest band in the world, is going to go out and do their first live performance for 3 years and slay them. Everybody is going to be talking about this performance because there are moments where they look a little bit shambolic. So I think that would be my feeling. Is this going to work? But then, do you know what? I think some of the greatest bits of the documentary are the bits when it doesn't work. And there's, because it's at the end of the first week, isn't it, at Twickenham, when there's a kind of suggestion that the documentary is falling apart, and both Lennon and McCartney say, oh, it's not. It's just taking off. Because George has walked out. It's like, there's your documentary. So I think if I was Michael Lindsay Hogg, part of me would be thinking, well, I'm not going to get that big climactic live performance, but what I might get is something kind of far more interesting, which is the Beatles not managing to do a final live performance. So maybe I'd be thinking that. I don't know. I think as a documentary maker, which I'm clearly not, you've just got to go with what's in front of you, haven't you? It's like the old football managers approach. You know, you can only beat what's in front of you. And Michael Lindsay Hogg, why should he be saying what Beatles should be doing? What should be happening in this documentary? Film what is happening in the documentary. That's what documentary making is. So maybe I would be rubbing my hands together at the prospect of the Beatles not doing a live performance at the end of it. But I'm extraordinarily glad that they did, because it's wonderful. And I'd like to state for the record that Alan Klein is not Saruman from Lord of the Rings. Let's just make that perfectly clear, Chris.
Bob Fisher, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.